from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. With the successful detonation of a nuclear device in New Mexico in July 1945, the atomic age was born. The Manhattan Project, as the test was named, contributed dramatically to the debate about scientists and social responsibility. To what extent are scientists responsible for the ethical, social, and cultural implications of their research? How should scientists talk to society about these implications? Those questions are central to a forthcoming book by one scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. He is Alan Byershin, a professor of history at Ohio State University. Alan Byershin is at work on a study about James Franck, a German physicist and Nobel laureate who participated in the Manhattan Project and the development of the atomic bomb in the 1930s and early 1940s. Alan Byershin is the author of Scientists Under Hitler, published by Yale University Press in 1977 and issued in paperback in 1981. Alan Byershin, let's begin our conversation about science and social responsibility. Tell me about James Franck. Why does he provide an avenue into this topic for you?
Well, Franck was a very interesting man, a Nobel Prize winner in physics, a German Jew, who, among other things, was trained at the turn of the century with all of the big guns of science. He knew Max Planck, the originator of the quantum theory. He knew Albert Einstein. Was on first-name basis with many of the really important figures like Niels Bohr in the 1910 to 1930 period or so.
When did he live?
He was born in 1882, and he died in 1964, so he was 82 years old when he died, and lived through a very exciting part of the 20th century when a large number of very important discoveries were made, and he made some of them, which is why he got the Nobel Prize. He was also engaged in gas warfare in the First World War. In 1933, when Hitler came to power, he made a very strong political stand against the Nazis. He resigned his position in the university town of Göttingen in public protest. I mean, he got it into the newspapers and everything, which was quite an accomplishment given the control of the newspapers by the Nazis already by April of 1933. In 1945, his name is associated with a very famous report that was issued within the Manhattan Project that suggested we should not bomb Japanese population centers with the first weapons, but should demonstrate them in some sort of non-lethal manner, perhaps on a desert island or something, before we then went ahead and proceeded to use the bombs against the Japanese and killed people with them. The Franck Report is often regarded as one of the most important statements of social conscience among scientists in the 20th century.
Would you say that James Franck spoke for the majority of conscientious scientists?
Then again, you're talking about a majority of a minority, right?
Yeah.
Yes. He spoke for many of the scientists who are concerned with the not only responsibilities but the whole ethical questions of the uses of science and abuses of science, the role of which the interaction between science and technology, and the changing nature of that interaction in the course of the 20th century, so that by the end of World War II, it was clear that science was intricately tied to technology that could be used for military purposes.
Right.
All of that was a development that was very gradual, and most scientists were not really aware of the implications of this development. During World War II, many of them had been engaged in science projects that were related to the war effort, but they were so heavily engaged in radar, for example, as well as Manhattan Project, that they did not have time to really reflect on what was going on.
Alan Byershin, would you say that that James Franck, well, you may not want to speak specifically about him, but generalize for me, are scientists short-sighted about the ethical, the social implications of the work that they engage in? It sounds to me, listening to your summary thus far about the life, the career, the scientific work of James Franck, that they're not. And yet somehow they come in for a lot of criticism. Do I have that right?
Yes, you have both counts right. One, that they're regarded as not wanting to participate, and two, that they are indeed far-sighted enough to know what's going on. Both are correct. You see, the apparent contradiction there is that if they know what's going on, they ought to be involved, right?
Right.
That is not necessarily the way scientists look at it, and that's because of the whole historical development of modern science.
The way that they themselves look at science?
Yes, they look at science as something abstracted from politics, dealing with reality. Politics deals with ephemeral things for the scientists. Scientists are dealing with something like a discovery that will be added to our knowledge permanently.
Yeah, but now wait a minute. They walk and live and breathe in a social world. Mm-hmm. How can they separate the two?
Well, you see, as I say, it's wrapped up with the whole development of modern science. Let me digress for just a moment and give you
sure.
some of that development as I understand it. What we call modern science came about mostly in the 17th century, that is the era of Galileo and Newton in the 1600s. In that period, especially in Northern Europe, the people involved in science found that the way they could actually engage in the activity that mattered to them, to investigate nature, was to carve out a territory that was neither religious nor political. There were lots and lots of fights. This was the century also of the English Civil War, the Great Civil War with Cromwell involved and so on. And scientists found that if they that they could provide a meeting ground where people who were Catholic or Protestant or non-believers could all come together and agree upon ways to approach nature and approach reality
sure,
without having to kill each other,
The word is objectivity.
That's right. That's where the word objectivity comes in. And with the achievements of Newton toward the end of the 1600s, many scientists had thought that they had proven the validity of this approach. And during the 18th and the 19th centuries, gradually a process we call professionalization took place,
right.
where the scientists developed career patterns, developed their own organizations, developed journals in which to exchange their ideas.
They found homes in the universities.
That's right. The whole career pattern tied to the universities evolved, especially in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually scientists developed a subculture, if you will, which provided a great deal of autonomy for the disciplines, that is physics, chemistry, biology, and so on, for the scientists.
Well, is the division, Alan Bearshain, is the division between the scientists and the general populace and the views that they have of one of the other, would you say that the burden is more on the scientists for not talking to the general society, or is it our fault in the sense of the layman who don't inquire of the scientists, don't press them for answers, and don't invite them into the social fold?
No, I think we press the scientists for answers. If anything, we press them for too many answers about too many things.
Mm-hmm.
In the course of the 20th century, in particular, we have come to regard science as the ultimate authority. Many people regard it as at least as important as religion for answering everyday questions.
Sure.
And the scientists have been drawn into court debates over the beginning of when life begins. They have been drawn into cases regarding cost-benefit analyses of whether we should build nuclear plants at a given location, what are the risks involved, and toxicology studies, what are the risks, for example, of something like the recent disaster in India.
Mm-hmm.
What could happen? And oftentimes scientists really don't know much more than other citizens what could happen. They can know in terms of what is technically possible, but what risks are necessary to accomplish other objectives are not really that's not really the province of scientists. And so we pressure them to give us answers actually for which they're not prepared. And many scientists withdraw from that pressure. They withdraw because they know they're being stretched to explore areas where they don't have knowledge but only guesswork to offer.
Well, let's focus on, we're talking about James Franck, we're talking about the mm-hmm. social responsibility of the scientist. Alan Bearshain, tell me, in terms of this one single person, how do these issues come to rest? Why do you look at him as an example of social responsibility and the modern scientist?
Well, because Franck was involved in some of the most interesting intersections of politics and science in our century. I mentioned World War I. I mentioned the rise of the Nazis. I mentioned the Manhattan Project in World War II. There are others as well.
Alan, do you look upon him as some sort of a prophet? And I don't mean that in the strictest literal sense. Did he tell us things that we ignored, that we should have listened to, that we're not listening to now?
No, that's not the way I'm approaching it.
Okay.
I don't approach him the way some people say approach Einstein, as a wise man who had answers that the rest of us are only now beginning to understand.
Uh-huh.
No, Franck, if anything, was a very typical scientist, unlike a man like Einstein. Frank never saw himself as a genius, never saw himself as a even one of the great pathbreakers like Planck or Bohr.
Well, then why is he important?
Precisely because he is typical.
Uh-huh.
Precisely because looking at his career gives us a sense of where scientists have come in the course of the 20th century. He believed in a sort of a harmony between science and his country,
mm-hmm.
that most scientists, in fact, almost everyone, there were very few exceptions. Einstein was one of the few who didn't think of himself as so much German as Swiss during this period. But most scientists in the Allied countries, as well as in the Central Powers countries, believed that their national duty and their duty to science were consonant. There was no automatic conflict. And it was in the course of the 1920s, as Frank saw the rise of the Nazis, and then in the early 1930s, as the Nazis came to power in 1933 in particular, Frank realized that it was possible for his government to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, he saw a conflict between science and government that he had never seen before, and resigned in protest, saying he could not hold a government position under the Nazis.
And yet he comes to America and helps in the creation of a bomb, which in turn destroys how many thousands of lives?
Scores of thousands.
Yeah, in Japan.
That's right. Well, there's more to the story, you see. When he came to this country, he eventually ended up at the University of Chicago. He was at that point he'd always been interested in the impact of light upon molecules and light upon atoms, and chlorophyll is a very interesting molecule. So he had gotten interested in the impact of light on chlorophyll, and thus he got interested in photosynthesis, and was therefore not involved in nuclear physics, and was therefore not one of the early members of the Manhattan Project. He was drawn into it gradually, in fact, at the end of 1942. And at this point, when he was asked to join, he did something no one else did.
And that was?
To specify that he would have the right to express any reservations he'd have about this project at the mm-hmm. highest policy-making levels of government.
And was this the exception or the rule?
Very much the exception. Nobody else put in kind of stipulation like this.
But they let him in because he was who he was.
Because they needed him at that particular point. They needed someone to head the chemistry division of the Metallurgical Laboratory in Chicago, and he was there. He knew Arthur Compton very well, and Compton was a Nobel Prize winner in charge of that end of the Manhattan Project. And Compton agreed personally to this request of Frank. As I say, no one else made this demand. And I think it relates directly back to his experiences in gas warfare. He saw how science was used by the military. He understood something I think that very few of the scientists understood, and that was that once you produce a weapon for the military will by and large determine how to use it.
Yep.
Most of the other scientists, in fact, nearly everyone among the scientists, thought that they were in control of the Manhattan Project. Even as late as 1945, most of the scientists thought that we started this project, we're the ones who determine how the bomb would be used.
Now, wait a minute. That sounds awfully naive.
It was, but it was the reality. Very few scientists saw that the matter was out of their own hands.
They weren't dismissed. The scientists weren't dismissed as a bunch of naive.
No, not at all.
In
the spring of 1945, then, Frank asked Compton to redeem that promise.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a special report that he wanted to try to get to Secretary of War Stimson. It turned out that he wasn't able to quite do that, but he did take it to Washington. And on the basis of ginning up this report, which suggested that the whole post-war world was going to be changed by nuclear power, both in terms of energy supplies for civilian uses and in terms of the warfare, that war as we understood it would no longer be possible after the development of this weapon. On the basis of that report, Frank was put in charge of a committee, the Committee on Political and Social Implications. Implied was the rest of the phrase of the weapon.
All right, now wait. Committee convened by another committee?
This
reporting
committee
to whom,
was
what?
Convened by Arthur Compton at Chicago within the Manhattan Project. It was this committee that turned out then a report, which we call the Frank Report, in June of 1945. And on this committee were Leo Szilard, Eugene Bovinovich, Glenn Seaborg, later who was in charge of the Atomic Energy Commission,
the AEC, right.
Nobel Prize winner, and a number of other persons who were directly concerned with the social and political complications that would emerge from this weapon. So Frank's decision in 1942, which I related back to his experiences in World War I,
mm-hmm.
paid off in 1945 with an effort to get the government to understand the implications of the new weapon. Now, were they listened to in the Frank Report?
Yeah.
That becomes an important question. And the answer is only partially. Clearly, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were still bombed.
All right, now wait. What part of the Frank Report was listened to? I mean, what did he say in this report? Can you reduce it to two or three generalizations?
Right. First was the notion that based on a particular premise, that the knowledge of fission was common property of scientists all over the world. There was nothing secret. There was no military classifiable secret related to the process of nuclear fission. This is the way nature works, mm-hmm. and any scientist anywhere in the world who had the proper training would be able to understand it and would be able to figure out the general lines of how to make a bomb. The only real secret about a bomb is whether or not it would work. Yeah. And when we used it, we would get rid of that secret quick, and it would be public knowledge. And the Trinity test in Alamogordo, New Mexico, of course, was still super secret, but Hiroshima immediately gave away the only real secret of the atomic bomb. There were some technological difficulties that could be overcome only with a very large industrial complex available, with an awful lot of money and a lot of engineers at work for a number of years. And the people on the front committee suggested this might be on the order of about 5 years or so. Mm-hmm. General Groves, the head of the Manhattan Project at this time, by the way, was thinking it would take 20 years for another country to catch up with us, which was a very bad miscalculation. But the people on this committee said more on the order of five. Based on these considerations, they said there are a number of major concerns. One is the way the weapon is introduced. If it is used first to kill people without an effort to demonstrate it, then we will lose, the United States, would lose a tremendous amount of moral support in the post-war world. It would tarnish America's image as a champion of the free peoples of the world. Secondly, they argued that once we use the weapon on the Japanese, to end the war, we would send a signal to the Russians that could be interpreted a number of different ways, only one of which was that the Russians better not try to mess with us. Mm. Another message would be the Russians better double their efforts or triple or quadruple their efforts to get a weapon to match us. And an arms race was very likely. That's one of the most prophetic statements of the of the Frank Report, and one that is often looked back to as saying this report had a lot to say.
Certainly came
and
true.
And thirdly, they argued that to avoid an arms race, which they saw as catastrophic for mankind in the long run, very likely to lead to perhaps even the extinction of mankind, was to set up some mechanism of international control. At this time, you must remember, there were very high hopes for the United Nations, which had convened for the first time in April of 1945 in San Francisco. And the New York building wasn't even built yet. I mean, this was still wartime. And they were hoping that some sort of international control mechanism could be worked out. And they said that we ought to at least try. And then if we have to, fall back on national security measures. But we ought to try for international control because, among other things, America is much more vulnerable to nuclear attack than any other country in the world. Mm-hmm. Certainly more so than Russia, which has only a couple of major population centers like Kiev and Moscow and Leningrad, where we have dozens of cities that would be very, very appropriate targets for nuclear weapons. We are more vulnerable than anybody else, and therefore it's even in our own best interest disregarding ethical considerations. It's in our own self-interest to find a mechanism for international control to avoid an arms race and the potential Armageddon that would come out of an arms race. So that was what the report was all about.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation about scientists and social responsibility. My guest is Alan Byershin, a professor of history at Ohio State University, who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. At the center, Alan Byershin worked on a forthcoming book about the life and work of James Franck, the German physicist and Nobel laureate who lived from 1882 till 1964 and who participated in the development of the atomic bomb. Alan Byershin is the author of Scientists Under Hitler, published by Yale University Press in 1977. Alan Byershin, tell me, how would you characterize the legacy of James Franck? My sense is that we didn't listen to this man. We didn't listen to this report. We're poised. The headlines are scary, but we don't seem to pay attention to them. Just recently, we've had scientific commissions which have announced the probability of nuclear winter. Are we going to listen to this? Do we just continue on? What?
Well, you ask about the legacy of Franck first, so let me go back to that, especially in regard to nuclear winter. Because the legacy of Franck was, first of all, immediate, in that he and the people associated with him, I've already mentioned Rabinovich and Szilard, is two of the most important, were directly involved in the effort in 1945, 46, and 47 to set up a civilian atomic energy agency, which became the Atomic Energy Commission. Mm-hmm. They were very active in Washington. They lobbied on behalf of civilian control of atomic energy, and successfully. That's one legacy. Secondly, they set up the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists and the organizations like the Federation of Atomic Scientists that were associated with it, where concerned scientists could get together, exchange ideas, and map out strategies for somehow making the public aware of real dangers and of keeping an eye on people who were less concerned with those dangers than these particular scientists. So those kinds of organizations are part of the legacy of Frank and the men like him. Thirdly, most importantly, discussions like we're having right now.
Uh-huh.
Come.
Just bringing it to public attention.
Bring it to public attention. Frank's, part of the legacy of Frank is that we can talk about a man like Frank. We can mm-hmm. say there was someone who tried. And even his failures tell us a great deal about what we ought to be doing.
All right, Alan. Let me stop you on that. Alan Barashain, your topic is science and the social responsibility of the scientist. All of what you've been saying here sort of presupposes the fact that somebody's going to listen to what these scientists have to say. Is there anything in practical terms that a socially responsible scientist can do? What do? You just leave the lab, you get up and you say, I'm not going to do this anymore. This is leading to the end of the world. Do we want to be naive and say, well, if we stop, the other guys are going to stop? It doesn't seem to work that way. What do scientists do to impress upon the public, as you say, the enormous seriousness of the implications of the work that they do?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first and most important thing is that they have layers of responsibility they have to recognize and then act upon. Some of those responsibilities are strictly professional. You know, there are professional obligations to be competent, to pursue science with integrity, not to fudge data or to ignore data that's relevant or mm-hmm. to give credit to a person who doesn't deserve it or to take credit away from someone. All of those responsibilities are within the profession.
Sure, but where you're leading now is that it finally, the buck is finally going to stop with the politicians and not the scientists.
No, not necessarily. Let me finish, because I'm going to suggest that there are two levels of responsibility that the scientists must deal with both individually and as a member of a group. One of those is that the scientist has a very specific responsibility to foster governments and government policies that encourage the pursuit of science with integrity.
Is that happening?
Yes, to a large extent. Scientists do feel this concern. They recognize that it is in their interest to make sure that governments exist which allow them to be honest, mm-hmm. to not have to falsify data, to not have to say that something is scientifically correct when it isn't. Now, there have been, in the United States, we sort of take for granted that governments allow scientists to tell the truth. That is not necessarily always the case. We look at the Eastern European countries, we look at countries in Latin America, we can look at the case of Nazi Germany and find that there are governments in this century which have made it very difficult for scientists to be honest about their data, about credit, about what they have discovered or what they think is reality. But beyond that, I would like to say that the scientists have yet another layer of responsibility.
And what is
so
that?
Beyond the professional internal responsibilities within the profession, the responsibility is to foster governments and government policies that encourage the pursuit of integrity of science with integrity. They also have the responsibility for the likely consequences of their work. That's what most people drive at right away. But you have to get there by stages. You can't just say to a scientist, hey, you're responsible for any consequences that come out of your work. Because a scientist is very likely to turn around and say, how am I supposed to know all the possible consequences?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you force the person into a defensive posture where he says, okay, I'm not responsible for none. Mm-hmm. Okay. The scientist is responsible for the likely consequences. He normally, or she normally, can project those and has to, say, in grant proposals. Mm-hmm. You can see the likely consequences, and normally you say, well, these are the beneficial consequences because I like the government or whatever to support me.
Is that ingredient in the kinds of discourse that occur between scientists and the people who give them money?
Absolutely. The scientists must see likely consequences in order to get the funding.
No, I'm talking about the ethical dimension. Do they talk explicitly about that sort of thing?
It comes in stages. Let me just go one more step and then answer your question directly. Because the scientists, by and large, assume still, to a very large extent, that their science is going to come out with beneficial consequences. And if not beneficial, it's because somebody else fouled up, because mm-hmm. somebody else was evil by nature and did something terrible with what otherwise could be used for good purposes.
Right.
And there's a lot of truth to the idea that all knowledge can be used for either good or evil.
Yep.
But the scientists have a responsibility to point out both the beneficial and the detrimental likely mm-hmm. consequences of mm-hmm. the work. Not all consequences, because that's impossible, but likely or probable consequences are their responsibility to enunciate.
Alan Barashain, let's conclude our conversation about science and the social responsibility of scientists. Let me make you uncomfortable for a moment. A few moments ago, you used the word evil. We've been talking about science. Early in our conversation, you characterized an enormous historical shift that occurred when science assumed a sort of, it became an idol, I think you said, in mm-hmm. society. How do scientists think about moral issues? How do they think about where evil comes from and where the good of society comes from? Do they talk to one another about questions like that?
Oh, sure they do. But it's very difficult to generalize about all scientists.
Well, like
give me if you said, what do Americans think about evil? You know, that question is almost impossible to answer.
Fair enough. Reduce it to an example that that you would be comfortable with. Is that possible?
Well, how about Frank?
Okay.
Okay, since he's the one we're talking about today. Frank's concern with evil was that it comes out of fear. It comes out of insecurity. And it is tied up with lies and lack of integrity.
And this gets back to what you were saying about the scientist doing science with integrity.
That's right. Uh-huh. That's right. Scientists see the lack of integrity as one of the great threats to the confrontation with reality.
So it's not just a compromise in the sense of political infighting or personality conflicts. It has to do, they really do think of it in sort of cosmic terms.
Well, scientists believe, for the most part, fundamentally, down deep in the bottom of their sneakers, if you will, since many of them are wearing running shoes to work even, that science is ultimately got to be beneficial for mankind. Uh-huh. That it's better to have knowledge than ignorance.
Yeah, right.
And they make that fundamental ethical judgment very early on. They're socialized, that is, in the process of training. They are taught to believe this in the university laboratories, and they learn it from their professors, they learn it from their colleagues, and they're reinforced in that belief at all times. So they're fundamentally convinced, like, say, physicians, that they are doing something that is good for man.
It's a healing kind of thing.
Knowledge itself, let's put it this way. One of my professors once said that ignorance is a hurt.
Uh-huh.
And if you hurt, you're going to try to somehow get rid of that pain. You're going to try to deal with it. You're going to try to stop it. And the way you deal with ignorance is to pursue knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you once understand ignorance is a hurt and you understand that knowledge is healing, then the pursuit of knowledge becomes one of the most important, one of the most satisfying, one of the most healthy processes in which you can engage and in which you can bring others to be engaged.
Alan Barashain, quick final shot here. What would you have a general audience know about science and social responsibility?
That it's a two-way street.
Uh-huh.
That it's a two-way street. The scientists have gradually come to realize that, especially with greater amounts of funding coming from public sources and massive amounts of funding, not just greater, but massive amounts, they have public responsibilities. They're aware of that. They're willing to exercise them, but they're not willing to answer questions that the public often demands answers to that cannot be based on scientific knowledge at all, but are based on other considerations like politics and religion. And so we have to realize that if we ask certain kinds of questions of the scientists, they simply can't answer. They'll draw back and say, that's not my affair. If you ask other questions, the scientists will be forthcoming and will want to be forthcoming because of their own sense of responsibility.
So to say that a scientist has a social responsibility is to say that a citizen has a social responsibility.
Well, of course, all scientists are citizens, and there's
sure.
that meaning too. But I would say that both science and society have interlocking responsibilities, and both sides need to be aware of what's possible and what's necessary.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation about scientists and social responsibility. My guest was Alan Barashain, a professor of history at Ohio State University, who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. At the center, Alan Barashain worked on a forthcoming book about the life and work of James Franck, the German physicist and Nobel laureate who participated in the development of the atomic bomb. Alan Barashain's first book about scientists and social responsibility was Scientists Under Hitler, published by Yale University Press in 1977. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about art and society. My guests will be Arthur Danto of Columbia University and Michael Shapiro of the St. Louis Museum of Art. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.